Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Oldest Story Ever Told by Romaine Gary. La Paz is 12,000 feet above sea level. Any higher and it is impossible for men to breathe. There are llamas, Indians, arid plateau, eternal snows, ghost towns, eagles, and below in the tropical valleys wander gold prospectors and giant butterflies. Schoenbaum had dreamed of La Paz, the capital of Bolivia, almost every night during the 2 years he had spent in the Torenberg concentration camp in Germany. And when the American troops at last opened the gates to what seemed to be another world, he struggled to obtain his Bolivian visa with that tenacity which only true dreamers can translate into action. Schoenbaum was a tailor by profession, a tailor in Lodz, in Poland, heir to a great tradition which 5 generations of Jewish tailors had made illustrious. He settled in La Paz, and after a few years of diligent labor, he was able to set up on his own and soon enjoyed comparative prosperity under the sign Schoenbaum Paris Tailor. Orders flowed in, and soon he had to look for an assistant. This wasn't easy. The Indians of the upper Andes provide the world with an astonishingly limited number of Paris tailors, and delicacy with a needle is not often one of their crafts. Schoenbaum had to spend too much time teaching them the rudiments of the art for such a collaboration to be profitable. After several attempts, he resigned himself to remaining alone despite the mounting load of work. But an unexpected encounter solved his problem in a manner that, he was certain, revealed the hand of Providence, which had always shown itself well disposed towards him, since of the 300,000 Jews from Lodz, he was one of the few survivors. Schoenbaum lived on the heights above the town, and the llama trains passed under his window from dawn on, by virtue of an ordinance issued by a government anxious to give the capital a modern aspect. The streets of La Paz are forbidden to these animals, but since they constitute the sole means of transport on the mountain trails, the spectacle of the llamas leaving the city limits at dawn under their burden of crates and sacks is, and will doubtless remain, for some time familiar to all visitors to the country. Every morning, then, as he was walking to his shop, Schoenbaum met these llama trains. He was fond of the llamas, without quite knowing why, perhaps simply because they are none in Germany. 2 or 3 Indians usually led towards the village of the Andes caravans of 20 or 30 animals able to carry burdens which often amounted to several times their own weight. One day, when the sun had just risen, as he was walking down to La Paz, Schoenbaum passed one of these caravans, the sight of which always made him smile. He paused and held out his hand to stroke a passing animal. He never caressed a cat or dog, both of which abound in Germany, and he never listened to the birds which sing in Germany, too. There is no doubt that his experiences in the extermination camps had made him somewhat reserved towards the Germans. He was patting the animal's flank when his eyes were drawn to the face of the Indian walking beside it. The man was barefoot, a staff in his hand, and at first Schoenbaum paid him scarcely any attention. His casual glance almost left his face forever. It was a yellowish, fleshless face, with an eroded and stony aspect which seemed to have been created by centuries of physiological misery. But something known, something familiar and yet terrifying and nightmarish, suddenly stirred in Schoenbaum's mind and wakened in him an extreme agitation, while his memory still refused to help him. That toothless mouth, those large, gentle brown eyes opened on the world like a perpetual wound, that sad, long nose, that expression of permanent reproach, half question, half accusation, hovering on the face of the man walking beside his llama, literally leaped upon the tailor when he had already turned his back. He uttered a muffled exclamation and whirled around. "Glückmann," he shrieked. "What are you doing here?" Instinctively, he had spoken in Yiddish, and the man thus addressed leaped to one side as if he had suddenly been scorched. Then he began running along the road, pursued by Schoenbaum, who loped behind him with an agility of which he had never thought himself capable, while the llamas, with their arrogant expression of disdain, continued on their way with deliberate steps. He caught up with the man at the turn in the road, grabbed his shoulder, and forced him to stop. Gluckman, beyond a doubt. It was not only the similarity of features that convinced him, no. Above all, it was that expression of suffering, of mute interrogation, which was impossible to mistake. Why are you doing this to me? The eyes were perpetually asking. Gluckman stood cornered, his back against the red rock, his mouth open, revealing his naked gums. It's you! Schoenbaum shouted, still in Yiddish. I tell you, it's you! Gluckman shook his head. It's not me, he howled back in Yiddish. My name's Pedro. I don't know you. And where did you learn to talk Yiddish? Schoenbaum screamed triumphantly. In the La Paz kindergarten? Gluckman's mouth opened still wider. He glanced wildly towards the llamas, as though seeking their help. Schoenbaum let him go. But what are you afraid of, you idiot? He asked. I'm a friend. Whom are you trying to fool? My name is Pedro, Gluckman whined in a shrill, pleading voice still in Yiddish. Complete Meshugana, Schoenbaum said pityingly. So, your name is Pedro? And this? He grabbed Gluckman's hand and looked at his fingers. Not one nail. And this? I suppose it was the Indians who ripped off your nails, roots and all? Gluckman pressed still closer against the rock. His mouth closed slowly and the tears began running down his cheeks. You're not going to turn me in, he stammered. Turn you in? Schoenbaum repeated. To whom? To whom should I turn you in? A hideous comprehension suddenly gripped his throat. Sweat burst out on his forehead. He was overcome with fear, that hideous fear which suddenly peoples the whole earth with hidden dangers. Then he managed to gain control of himself. But it's over, he shouted. It's been over for 15 years. Hitler is dead and buried. Up and down Gluckman's long, fleshless neck, the Adam's apple moved spasmodically, while a kind of cunning grin flickered across his face. They always say that. I don't believe their promises. Schoenbaum took a deep breath. They were 12,000 feet above sea level, but he knew the altitude had nothing to do with it. Gluckman, he said solemnly, you've always been an idiot. Even so, make an effort. It's over. There is no more Hitler. No more SS. No more gas chambers. We even have a country of our own, Israel, that has an army, a judiciary, a government. It's over. There's no need to hide anymore. Ha ha ha, Gluckman laughed without a trace of gaiety. That won't work with me. What won't work? Schoenbaum shouted. Israel, Gluckman declared. It doesn't exist. What do you mean it doesn't exist? Schoenbaum thundered, stamping his foot. It does so exist. Haven't you read the papers? Ha, Gluckman said simply, with an infinitely sly expression. But there's even an Israeli consul here in La Paz. You can get a visa. You can go there. It won't work with me, Gluckman declared. Another German trick. Schoenbaum was beginning to get goose flesh. What frightened him most was Gluckman's superior expression. And what if he were right, he thought suddenly. The Germans were quite capable of such a trick. Present yourself at such and such a place with papers proving you're a Jew and you'll be taken to Israel free. You present yourself, you let them put you on the ship, and you find yourself back in an extermination camp. Gluckman was right. There could be no Israel. It was only another German trap. My God, he thought. What's happening to me? He wiped his forehead and tried to smile. Then he realized that Gluckman was talking, still with that sly and knowing expression. Israel's trick to get us all together, the last ones, all those who managed to get away, and then to gas us. It's pretty good. The Germans are clever. They know how to do things like that. They want to get us all there, just like the last time. And then, once we're together, I know them. We have our own Jewish state. Schoenbaum said gently, as one speaks to a child, the president's name is Ben-Gurion. There's an army. We sit in the United Nations. It's over, I tell you. It won't work, Gluckman declared. I know the trick. Schoenbaum put his arm around his friend's shoulder. Come, he said. You come and stay with me. We'll go see a doctor. It took him 2 days to make some sense out of the victim's incoherent remarks. Since his liberation, which he attributed to a temporary disagreement among the anti-Semites, Gluckman had been hiding in the upper plateau of the Andes, convinced that things would return to normal from one moment to the next, but that by passing himself off as an Indian llama driver of the Sierra, he might escape the Gestapo. Each time, Schoenbaum tried to explain to him that there was no more Gestapo, that Stryker, Rosenberg, Himmler were gone, that Germany was a nice democratic republic. He merely shrugged his shoulders with a sly, knowing look. He knew better. He wasn't going to let himself be trapped. When Schoenbaum, lacking any further arguments, showed him photographs of Israeli schools and army units with their happy, confident, and determined young men, Gluckman suddenly intoned a Kaddish for the dead. He mourned those new innocent victims who the enemy's God had managed to assemble in Israel in order to make their extermination easier, as in the days of the Warsaw Ghetto. That Gluckman was simple-minded, Schoenbaum had always known. More exactly, his reason had resisted less well than his body the nameless torments he had endured. At the camp, he had been the favorite victim of SS Commander Schultz, a sadistic brute carefully chosen by the authorities and altogether worthy, as he soon proved, of the confidence that Eichmann had shown in him. For some mysterious reason, he had made the wretched Gluckman the scapegoat, and none of the prisoners, connoisseurs though they were, supposed that Gluckman could emerge alive from his hands. Like Schoenbaum, he was a tailor by profession. Although his fingers had lost some skill in wielding the needle, he rapidly recovered enough agility to return to work, and the Paris tailor establishment could finally catch up with the orders that continued to flow in. Gluckman never spoke to anyone, worked in a dark corner of the floor behind the counter, hidden from the eyes of visitors, emerging only after dark to visit the llamas, whose coarse hair flanks he stroked for a long time, and his eyes still glowed with ghastly comprehension, a kind of total knowledge occasionally accentuated by a cunning and superior smile. He knew, and that was all there was to it, and the exact nature of that knowledge was something Schoenbaum tried not to think about. Twice he tried to run away. The first time, when Schoenbaum casually remarked that the day was the 16th anniversary of the fall of Hitler's Germany, and the second when a drunken Indian began shouting in the street that a great leader would come down from the mountains and take things in hand. It was not until 6 months after their encounter, during the week of Yom Kippur, that a perceptible change seemed to occur in Gluckman. He gave the impression of being sure of himself, almost serene, as though delivered. He no longer hid behind the counter, and one morning, as he came into the shop, Schoenbaum heard something almost incredible. Gluckman was singing, or precisely, he was mumbling under his nose an old Jewish tune from the borders of Russia. He glanced up at his friend, raised the thread to his lips, licked it, threaded the needle, and continued to mumble his old, sad, tender tune. Schoenbaum had a moment of hope. Perhaps the victim's terrible memories were finally fading. After lunch, Gluckman usually went to lie down on a mattress he kept in the back room of the shop. Yet he slept very little, remaining for hours at a time crouched in his corner, staring at the wall with a gaze that invested the most familiar objects with a quality of terror and turned each sound into a cry of agony. But one evening, returning unexpectedly to the shop to look for a forgotten key, Schoenbaum surprised his friend, furtively stowing a cold meal in a basket. The tailor found his key and left, but instead of returning home, he waited in the street, hidden in a doorway. Then he saw Gluckman creep out, the basket of food under his arm, and vanish into the night. Schoenbaum discovered that his friend disappeared this way every evening, always with a basket of food under his arm. And when he returned a little later, the basket would be empty and his face would have a cunning and complacent expression, as if he had just made an excellent bargain. The tailor was tempted to ask his assistant about the purpose of these nocturnal expeditions, but knowing his retiring nature and being reluctant to frighten him, he decided not to ask him any questions. He waited patiently in the street after work, and when he saw a furtive silhouette creeping out of the shop and gliding towards its mysterious destination, he followed. Gluckman walked quickly, keeping close to the walls, sometimes turning around as if he were trying to shake off a possible pursuer. All these precautions brought the tailor's curiosity to its peak. He leaped from doorway to doorway, concealing himself each time his assistant turned around. Night had fallen, and several times Schoenbaum almost lost track of his friend. Despite his corpulence and a rather weak heart, he nonetheless managed to catch up with him each time. Finally, Gluckman turned into a courtyard off the Avenue of the Revolution. The tailor waited a moment, then ran in on tiptoe behind him. He found himself in one of the courtyards of the great market of the Asunción, from which the llama train set out each morning towards the mountains. Indians were sleeping on heaps of straw and a stench of manure. The llamas stuck their long necks out of crates and shop fronts. A second exit opposite opened onto a narrow, dimly lit alley. Gluckman had vanished. The tailor waited a moment, then shrugged his shoulders and prepared to turn back. In attempting to cover his tracks, Gluckman had taken the longest way. Schoenbaum decided to return home directly, crossing the marketplace. He had no sooner started down the narrow passageway than his attention was attracted by the glow of a kerosene lamp that filtered through the skylight of a cellar. He glanced casually towards the light and saw Gluckman. He was standing in front of a table and taking food out of his basket, arranging the items in front of someone sitting on a stool with his back to the skylight. Gluckman set out a sausage, a bottle of beer, red pimentos, and bread. The man whose face Schoenberg still could not see spoke a few words, and Gluckman quickly rummaged in the basket for a cigar, which he also set on the tablecloth. The tailor had to make an effort to wrench his eyes from his friend's face, for it was terrifying. He was smiling, but the enormous, fixed, burning eyes lent this strangely triumphant smile something maniacal. At that moment, the man turned his head, and Schoenbaum recognized SS Commander Schultz, the torturer of the Thornburg camp. For one desperate second, the tailor clung to the hope that he might perhaps be the victim of a hallucination, or they had been mistaken. Yet, if there was one face he was in no danger of forgetting, it was indeed the monster's face. He recalled that Schultz had vanished after the war. Some people said he was dead. Some said he was living in hiding in South America. Now he saw the man with his own eyes. The arrogant, heavy jaw, the cropped hair, the mocking smile. But there was something more frightening still than the monster's presence, Gluckman's. By what hideous aberration could he be there, in front of the man whose favorite victim he had been, the man who had tortured him so relentlessly for over a year? What was the logic of the madness that drove him to come here every night, to feed his torture each night instead of killing him, or turning him over to the police? Schoenbaum felt his mind go blank. When he succeeded in its horror, all the limits of the endurable. He tried to cry out, to call for help, to alert the population, but all he could do was open his mouth and wave his arms. His voice refused to obey him, and he stood there staring with bulging eyes at the victim, who was opening the beer and filling the executioner's glass. He must have stood for a good minute in total unconsciousness. The monstrous absurdity of the scene taking place before his eyes finally robbed it of all reality. It was only when he heard a muffled exclamation beside him that he managed to regain control of himself. In the moonlight, he saw Gluckman standing by his side. The two men stared at each other a moment, one with outraged incomprehension, the other with a cunning and almost cruel smile on a face in which the eyes gleamed with all the fires of some triumphant madness. Then Schoenberg heard his own voice. He could scarcely recognize it. "He tortured you every day for over a year. He martyred you. He crucified you. And instead of calling the police, you bring him food every night? Is it possible? Am I dreaming? How can you?" On the victim's face, the expression of profound cunning grew more intense, and from the darkness of time rose the age-old voice that made the hair stand up on the tailor's head and froze his heart. "He's promised to treat me better the next time." Manskin by M.S. Waddell. He came towards the door of the house, and there was someone else standing in the porch, fumbling for a key. The young man had his in his hand, and the other stood aside and let him open the door, then stepped behind him into the hallway. The young man switched on the light and started to climb the stairs past the numbered green doors. Before he had reached the second landing, the light went out. He stopped, hand resting upon the banister. Odd. The other man must have put it off. Then he heard the slip-slop of it slowly dragging up after him, and saw the dark shape of the other in the stairwell. There was no other light switch, nothing he could do about it at all. In fact, beyond going back down the stairs, he already climbed to switch it on again at the bottom. He found that he didn't want to go past the other again. It was not a rational fear, but it grew in him as the other steps brought it shuffling up the stairs, its form still mingled with the darkness as though it were a part of it. He began to climb, and it seemed to him that the dark thing behind him increased its pace to keep up with him. Now and then he thought he could hear its labored breath. Now and again, the old house creaked under his feet. There was absolutely nothing to be afraid of. So he stopped on the fourth landing and waited for it to follow him up. But it did not come. He had heard no door open until the moment of his stopping. He had been conscious of the movement behind him on the stairs. It had not gone away. It was there, somewhere, behind him. When he had stopped, so had it. It was plainly waiting for him to start again. It was following him. He started slowly back down the stairs. Something moved, scuttled down there in the darkness. "Hello," he said. Then he called down the stairwell. "Are you there?" There was no reply. He came to the second landing. He was beginning to wonder if he hadn't imagined the whole thing. There was no one there in the darkness, no one at all. Going any further was daft. So he quickly lit a cigarette. He turned with a lighted match still in his hand, and it was standing there beside him, its body drawn up into the doorway, its white plastic face towards him, weak yellow eyes watching him. "Are you Will?" he said. It grinned and it nodded, and the lax skin of its throat flapped against its long jaw. Then it put out an arm and caught his sleeve and drew itself against him so that he found he was supporting its weight. It opened its mouth to speak, and nothing came, although its lips moved around its yellow teeth, and its tongue darted furtively to and fro inside. It was incapable of no intelligible sound. He started up the stairs with it. There wasn't much else he could do. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. There was nobody else to help. If the other did live in the house, it would surely stop at its own door. If it didn't, it would have still to be put up somewhere for the night, at least. So he climbed the stairs, less surely now, for the other's body weighed upon him. He found the guttural rasp of its breath through its open mouth distasteful. The webbing of its arms around him seemed to draw strength from him. With one long nail, it scratched and tested the pink skin of his neck. The young man reached his own door and turned the key, and they went through into the little corridor. The other doors that opened off it were still closed. No light showed from any of the other bedsits, so there was no chance of anybody else being able to help him. He walked the thing down the corridor to his own room, then rested its weight against the wall as he searched for the second key. He opened a door and switched on the light and turned to find that the thing had followed him inside, that it shielded its weak eyes from the glare of the lamp, arm flapping across its face. It sat on the bed and sank its face down to its chest and looked at the floor as a young man took off his coat. Damp and cold and stiff the poor thing was. Gray fingers, laced by its throat, fumbled across its face. Strands of white hair floated across its brow from beneath the peak cap it wore. Its black coat was frayed and tattered. Blue tennis shoes without laces peeped from the folds of the coat where it flopped on the floor, grotesquely too large for the poor thing. The young man picked up his shiny tin kettle and went down the corridor to the bathroom to fill it. The thing unbuttoned its coat and laid its canvas cloth on the table. When the young man returned, the light was out. He reached for the switch, clicked it, and nothing happened. He took a cautious step into the room, and the thing's cold hand came across his face. Its fingers lodged on his chin and forced back his head. The blood in his mouth was his own, and the twist of the meat skewer in his throat brought him gurgling to the bed, where the thing landed on his chest. At that point, the young man died. The swift stroke of the scalpel was on dead flesh, and his eyes, placed carefully in the ashtray, were unseeing. It was evening again. It had been back to the bedsit. Shivering cold, the poor thing came across the allotment, carefully skirting the points where the light from the street lamps flirted with the orderly furrows of the earth. Over its shoulder hung a sack, which flapped against its scrawny body. It was lithe and quick now. Soft earth surged against its feet. Yellow grass by the allotment edge stood as high as the knee of its braggy trousers. Into the allotment shed it went, closing the door behind it. It lit the oil lamp and untied its sack. It held the thing before it, stroked and probed and tested with its teeth. It was enjoying himself. Poor thing that it was, it had little enjoyment. It drew off its red rubber gloves and laid them back in the canvas cloth. There was the other thing in the sack to attend to. So it started out across the allotment again, pit-patting furtively across the soft earth, soft, damp warmth of the thing in the sack against its shoulder. It put down the sack down by the side of the manhole, painfully eased up the cover. Soft, damp things down there in the darkness. It held the sack over the hole, and the thing plopped and trickled down. Sour, sweet smell. It let the manhole cover slide back into position, started back across the crisscrossing paths. The man by the allotment fence watched the poor thing go. Doc played with his mind, but didn't bring him to a decision. Whatever was going on was the other fellow's business. So he started down the road to home and decided to forget about it. Arthur, he said to himself, keep your nose out of it. Just time to go home and change, then back to the pub. Arthur Lawton was looking forward to getting to the pub. He forgot all about the thing in its sack. His skin was thick and coarse and kept his innards warm. He would have done well to remember. The poor damn thing stood in the darkness by the door of the junk shop. It still wore its heavy coat, but now there wasn't a white hair to be seen beneath its cap. Its chin still rested on his chest, as though the breastbone had risen up to meet it. It was looking at its tennis shoes, but in reality was watching the young man behind the counter. "Selling 'em, Dad?" the young man asked. The poor thing shivered. The young man handled the cloth with distaste. He became conscious of the frightened yellow eyes that watched him, the hands that played across the fragile face, tattered sleeves, bony wrists, dirty hands. Dirty old man, always bringing in clothes. Could be his own, always about the size. Probably not, though. Sailor's things, once, and a dark corporation coat another time. Rag and bone. But then, he never made a bargain. Took anything. Funny. "Where'd you get 'em, Dad?" he asked, fingering the cloth. It had been a reasonably good suit once. Its gray fingers flew to its mouth. It seemed to speak, but its words were lost entirely in the furtive cluster of its fingers. "Speak up, Dad." It advanced from the shadow. It put its hands on the suit and tried to tug it from the grasp. "Here, Dad," the young man asked. It let out a whimpering sound, withdrew its hand, which flashed up to its face again, played with the loose skin of its throat. It stood mouthing before him, feverishly moving its lips behind its fluttering palm. The young man picked the suit up. His eyes followed him anxiously. "You've got a lot of these, ain't you, Dad?" the young man asked. "You keep bringing them in. Where are you getting them? Not nicking them, are you?" It shivered. Its hand groped forward again, trying to take back the suit. Well, it was money for old rope. No names, no pack drill. What if he was pinching them? The old fool was off his nut. "Okay, Dad," the young man said, swiftly dragging the suit to his side of the counter. The grimy note, which he fished out from the box beneath the counter, was quickly covered by its hand. It tucked the note away. Methodically, the young man ran his fingers through the pockets. The heavy watch flopped out on the counter. The young man tried to cover it with a cloth, but the frightened eyes had seen it. "Giving it away, are you?" the young man asked. It had turned for the door. It grasped the handle and turned it the wrong way. The young man came around the corner, holding the watch. It started to shake the door. "Here, Dad," the young man said, "do leave off." It looked over its shoulder at the advancing youth and grabbed something soundless. Then it managed to open the door and thrust itself clear of the young man's restraining hand. It bobbed off down the road in the darkness, long legs flapping. When it finally stopped, it was back in the shadows by the canal bank where nobody could see it. It slipped off its cap and put it into its pocket, then let its fingers slip rapidly over its bald head. It shouldn't come out without its hair. Arthur Lawton's lonely song soared over the allotments. Cheery and beery as he was not cold, for the drink in him made the whole world warm and happy. Long past the point of caring exactly where he was going, he allowed himself to be guided by it. It appeared from nowhere and took his arm. Arthur was convinced that more hospitality lay ahead. They picked their way through the plots to the allotment shed. Arthur completed the last 100 yards with the assistance of its wiry arm laced firmly around his middle. The door of the allotment shed opened to its touch, and Arthur staggered in with it. It lit the oil lamp while Arthur sat on an upturned packing case, enjoying counting his feet. They had become confused. 2 he had, of that he was certain. It was merely a matter of reassurance. Touching each foot with difficulty, finally established that all was well, quantity and quality. He screwed himself back into an upright position, taking the tin mug that was offered to him. The light from the oil lamp glistened on its damp face. showed him the thin streak of black hair that now grazed its brow. It surveyed Arthur with a businesslike smile on its thin lips. Like a bloody vampire, he thought, in a lucid movement. Its fingers played across its face, eased the flap of loose skin that fell across its forehead. Weak eyes watched Arthur as he drank. Arthur started to talk to it. It had nothing to say to him, but Arthur did not notice. He was altogether preoccupied with his own problems. Words seemed to come from him with great ease. Fluency of thought made him sob with the very impact of his own meaning on his mind. They were all barbarians, and Christ was crucified. It had turned away from him and was bending over a sheet in the corner where it fiddled through the pile of implements. It kept clean and sharp for the job. It took out a long kitchen knife and placed it on the canvas cloth that had spread on the earth floor. The thick rubber gloves, which it put on, covered its thin arms to the elbow. It slipped its hair from its head and put it carefully away. Arthur became aware of the change in its attitude gradually. He felt a hand on his arm, persuading him to drink again. The tin mug, which was thrust into his hand, was filled with a liquid yet more satisfying than the one before. He felt no compunction at all at letting it lower him from the packing case to the center of the canvas cloth. The thing was tender with him, and he was very fond of it. Oh, yes, very fond indeed. Putting one tired foot after another, the policeman brought himself up the road by the allotments. Life was difficult. He had another 3 hours on duty and no way of knowing what was going on at home and whether she was going to change her mind. If she didn't change her mind, he would have to switch the dates, and that would create all sorts of difficulties. He saw the light in the allotment shed and wondered idly what was going on there. He'd noticed it before and wondered about it. Some poor soul married to a nagger. He paused by the canal bank, wondering if it was worth a look. It was odd, and if anything was going on, he turned out of his way and moved between the allotments toward the lighted shed. The light went off. He quickened his step. 4 minutes brought him to the door. Nothing had passed him. The door was locked when he tried it. He knocked. He went to the back and tried the windows. They were closed tightly. Instinct told him there was someone inside. He stood before the door and spoke through it. No answer. Somebody would have a key. He went off to fetch it. 40 minutes later, he came back across the allotment. There was still no light in the shed, and he was beginning to wonder if there was any point in it. Again, he tried knocking on the door and flashing his torch through the window. Again, he had no success. He opened the door and flashed his torch inside. A lawnmower, a workbench, 4 packing cases, a tarpaulin on the floor rolled up in a bundle. He stepped in, guided his torch around the wall. There was a small instrument on the edge of the packing crate, a scalpel. He bent beside the tarpaulin, prodded it with his finger. It was soft. Propping the torch up on the packing rack, he unrolled the tarpaulin, and the raw, bleeding thing fell out on the ground before him. Tissue and muscle and sinew and the shiny knobs of bones practically intact. A soft mass that he knew for a man by the shape. Eyes in a lidless sockets, fleshless limbs that stuck together, lipless mouth and bared brain. There was a floppy pink something folded neatly inside it. Manskin. It was 4 hours later when they finally established where it lived. No one really seemed to know anything about it. It came and went from the allotment and muffled up against the cold. It fled from people. It had no friends. No two people could even agree on the color of its hair. They surrounded the house at 3 a.m. They came equipped to deal with it, but uneasy. Soft, skinless bodies they had found. That was quite bad enough. When it opened the door to them, it looked innocent. Its white hair flapped over its brow, and it seemed to know quite well why they had come for it. It had been sitting by its sewing machine, stitching. The needle still nestled in the plump flesh. It was making itself a set of combinations to keep it warm, poor thing. Like a deflated balloon, the skin lay across the table, knotted arms and knotted legs to stop the bleeding. It was a bit big for the poor thing in need of trimming. Then it would be skin tight, like the others.